everybody, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this is our Poltergeist episode. I guess we were thinking about doing this for a while, and then I was reminded of it when we watched Cool World, and Cool World was written by the screenwriting team of Michael Grace and Mark Victor. And after seeing Cool World, I just really had to know, like, because it was one of my least favorite screenplays I had ever witnessed on film. I had to know, like, what else these guys had done. And then I was like, oh, shit, Poltergeist. Oh, and then Poltergeist 2, they actually wrote and produced it. So that was even more their baby. So we watched Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2, The Other Side. And I had seen, like, parts of Poltergeist 2 on TV. And I think I'd seen all of Poltergeist more or less on TV as well. Many years ago. So this was pretty much seeing it for the first time. And it really was seeing it for the first time because, you know, on TV it was cropped, but I never realized it was a widescreen movie and such a lush one too. Mm-hmm. The widescreen cinematography is really, really beautiful. And actually this is like one of those movies, maybe it's the Spielberg thing, but like Jaws also kind of plays on TV cut up for you know, the TV size. Like, it's not – obviously it's not as good, but it still works. And Poltergeist worked on TV too. I never noticed – thought that it – like the screen seemed crowded or anything, which is usually the feeling I get from movies that got cropped for TV. But watching Poltergeist again, this is a really good movie, first and foremost. And, you know, there's some stuff about it that annoys me, but overall, it's just a good movie. And this was also something that I got that I thought about watching it this time around that I didn't think about when I was a kid was the controversy over who directed it, because Toby Hooper's credited at the beginning of the movie as the director. But infamously, when it came out, there were stories in the press, you know, pre-internet. So like there really had to be something to substantiate a rumor around at the time that Spielberg had to take over directing like at some point early on in, because Hooper, whatever, wasn't getting the job done for one reason or another. And, you know, if you were just – if I was just going to guess, like, oh, you know, I've seen a lot more Toby Hooper movies over the years now, you know, than just like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which doesn't even look like any of the movies that he did after the Texas Chainsaw Massacre hardly. So comparing his directorial style and Spielberg's to the movie, you know – a lot of it does feel like a Toby Hooper movie, especially with the use of tracking shots and kind of like shot reverse shot reactions with actors. Although I guess that's something that Spielberg does too. But I could believe, if I was just going to guess based on the style, that the movie was more or less 50-50, like probably half the scenes were Spielberg and half were Hooper. This movie has kind of been regarded as a Steven Spielberg movie since forever. And there's a lot of reading to do on the web. I found a pretty good, really good Poltergeist fan site, and we'll link to it on the alansmithy.com site. But, like, there's a lot of, like, the issue, it's amazing, but, like, this movie's 20 years old now, and the issue hasn't been resolved because the DVD came out a couple of years ago, like the 25th, or I guess it wouldn't be 25th.
It's 30. It's
30th. Yeah.
30th, yeah.
Okay. So a few years before, the 25th anniversary DVD came out, and it was called the Special Anniversary Edition and whatnot. And it had like a featurette on real life psychics because they can't get anybody to talk on camera, to give a statement or to agree with each other as to who really directed the thing. And that's the thing. Like, there's quotes from different actors on the set. Like, Zelda Rubinstein and Craig T. Nelson's stories don't jive. Like, you got to keep asking. Like, the more you read about what was going on, the more you ask, like, what the hell happened? And actually, the most interesting theory I found on this site, and the one that I can kind of believe almost because it's so simple that it just cuts through everything, is that, like, Hooper directed some scenes. Hooper directed most of it. Spielberg directed some of it. And then as the movie was coming out, like, this was the first movie that Steven Spielberg had produced and not directed. Spielberg started to get nervous that, like, they were releasing what was basically a horror movie from the director of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And they started thinking, like, even if this is PG rated, which it was, like, families aren't going to come see this Steven Spielberg production if they think it's a Tobe Hooper film. So let's start getting people to think that it's Spielberg through and through. And on that point, like, however much of it Hooper directed, it is certainly a Steven Spielberg type story, and it's got the mood and it's got all the, you know, all the sappy quirks of Spielberg written all over it. So, yeah, I can certainly think of it as a Steven Spielberg movie directed by Tobe Hooper, even more so than, you know, the other Spielberg-produced movies from the 80s like Gremlins or Back to the Future, although Gremlins, like, which was the next Spielberg-produced but directed by someone else film after this, like, I think a lot of people did go see Gremlins thinking that it was a Spielberg movie because it had Spielberg written all over it, and even the plot is kind of a goof on E.T. with a cute little furry non-human pet coming into a family, but then turning into a hideous monster.
Yeah, the Spielberg brand, and he's one of those guys who had a brand before anybody knew what a brand was. Yeah, it's funny because they still try to do it today. Like, you go to see – does anybody go to see Transformers or Cowboys and Aliens thinking Steven Spielberg, you know, really has anything to do with this besides cashing a check for $25 million or something? So I'm trying to remember, but the Gremlins experience of it being somehow Spielberg-related – that was a real thing. Like, when you talked about Gremlins, it wasn't, you know, the alternative to from the director of Texas Chainsaw. It wasn't, you know, from the director of Piranha.
Right.
Which it has more in common with.
Right.
Than one would think, really. I mean, Gremlins is, you know, I imagine if John Sayles had come back, like, and done Gremlins for Dante, it would have been a lot different.
but it would have fit
in that trilogy. And that's what Poltergeist is, sort of like the unofficial close to the Panavision Steven Spielberg that I talk about, that started with Sugarland Express, Jaws, Close Encounters, skipped over a couple movies, even Raiders it sort of skipped over. And I had to think about that Spielberg was coming off Raiders for this movie as a producer, and that sort of made him, you know, it as big of a name as if George Lucas had produced it, because when you look at it now, it's not that big of a deal, but Star Wars and Indiana and Raiders of the Lost Ark made incredible amounts of box office money for the time, just because, you know, as ticket prices rose and populations or whatever. So these names were very recognizable to mainstream moviegoers.
Yeah, and in a way, they were, like, recognizable in a way that movie directors or even producers' names didn't have a lot of cachet with audiences in the 50s or the 40s.
Right.
Like, John Ford, as many, you know, extremely popular movies as John Ford directed, people didn't go out to see the new John Ford movie.
Right. Yeah. So my thing with the whole controversy has always been, someone I knew once said, you know how you know Steven Spielberg didn't, you know, just sit down and direct this movie is the pot.
The pot, which I never, which I never saw on TV, which was neatly snipped out of television because back when I saw this on TV, you couldn't show smoking pot on basic cable.
Especially not like a positive sort of.
Right, a very neutral depiction of a married couple with kids, no less, casually.
They're just hanging out smoking pot when their daughter might be going insane in the next room. And then, of course, the big Zelda Rubinstein made that comment about how Hooper wasn't directing it.
Lest we forget what Randy Newman said, they walk around telling great big lies.
Well, the other thing is, having now seen Poltergeist 2, my opinion of Zelda Rubinstein's a little bit different than it was a couple days ago. So I don't exactly ever think of it as a Steven Spielberg movie. I mean, it's not even an Amblin production. Like, it's pre-Amblin. It's before the big, you know, the brand. It's as the branding just was picking up. And then the whole thing of there was a dispute over when it was going to come out against E.T. and that sort of thing. So I also don't think of it as a Toby Hooper movie, though, when I think of...
No, you can't. It's almost like it's its own thing in the end.
And it really is its own thing. And that's one of the things I noticed this time that became even more obvious after watching the second one is so much is implied. The weird thing is I remember, oh God, Ebert. We'll get the Ebert comment out of the way because I've never even looked up what he thought of these two.
Me either.
So that Lethal Weapon 2 starts in the second act, at the beginning of the second act, because it opens with them confronting bad guys. And Miami Vice actually does the same thing. I have no idea what Ebert said. Poltergeist kind of does that too. It like opens at the beginning of the second act and then backs up, gives you a little bit of the backstory of the characters while still moving through the plot, because Poltergeist first scene, you find out something's going on and it's to make it scary. And it got me thinking about Texas Chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
How he opens with the shots of
the corpses,
and that gets you. That got me freaked out.
Yeah, it sets a mood.
And I mean, Poltergeist, there's a weird mood setting that breaks the sort of very traditional.
It's structure. It's got weird mood swings that defy the three-act structure, because it's got the fake ending where, like, they get Carol Ann, the little girl, back from, you know, the spiritual netherworld inside this house, and then like a bunch of idiots, they say, let's stay one more night before we move out. which no one would ever do ever. But then you've got another like 15 minutes of movie where suddenly all kinds of crazy shit is happening again,
with expensive special effects.
Right, that's when they pull out all the really super expensive special effects, which, by the way, are freaking phenomenal.
Yeah,
special.
Edlund. I felt really bad because I didn't get excited when I saw his name, and I'm like, I really ought to be, because as far as practical effects go.
Yeah, well, the one thing I always remember him for doing is Ghostbusters. Like, I always remember seeing.
Right. See, that's kind of the problem. Is I feel like.
And Ghostbusters is great, but it's not as good. The effects aren't as good as they are in Poltergeist.
Even though
you got ghosts in both movies, but yeah.
Yeah, in the ghosts, it's.
Oh, and he did Big Trouble, Little China.
Yeah. So yeah, that's why I feel bad that I didn't. I don't.
Mm. But yeah, no, they're amazing.
Yeah.
And if the cast weren't so good, I would say that they're the best thing about the movie, besides the direction, whoever did it.
Whoever did it, yeah. It was probably – who was the director of photography? It was Matthew F. Lionetti's.
Oh, yeah. You pointed out when we were picking this that like it was pretty much all Spielberg's crew.
Yeah, Michael Kahn edits it, right?
Yeah, and like Mike Fenton was in the casting, and yeah.
But it's Jerry Goldsmith, and Spielberg would never work with Jerry Goldsmith.
Well, that's not true. He worked with him again on Twilight Zone after this.
Yeah, he kind of worked with him. I'm saying,
and I don't,
one of his movies.
No, and he scored Gremlins as well.
Well, I'm not as produced movies. I'm saying that Steven Spielberg as a director would never have a Jerry Goldsmith score.
Well, that's funny because like Goldsmith really does the warm and fuzzy thing really well, and Spielberg loves the warm and fuzzy feeling.
But he goes with Williams.
Yeah, who's not as good.
The music in this is great, and we're gonna. Ooh, I think I get the feeling we're gonna skip all over the place because I didn't see Poltergeist until I was. I want to say like 17 or 18. I mean, it took me a long time to see Poltergeist because I grew up with the Poltergeist phenomenon. Poltergeist was the big movie, and I clearly didn't go see scary movies. So it got to the kid dying part.
Yeah, there was the so-called Poltergeist curse.
And I just never got around to it. And what's interesting is that the Poltergeist series, not just the first one, is generally well
regarded,
reviewed.
Yeah,
I mean, the Maltin book gives Poltergeist 3.5, Poltergeist 2, 2.5, and Poltergeist 3, 2. And the comments on the second two are basically, oh, well, we like the kid or something. And it's relatively harmless, which I'll disagree with in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But it occurred to me that, you know, at some point I was like, I've never seen Poltergeist. Because if you're going to see if you're going to have like a Toby Hooper festival, you probably wouldn't watch Poltergeist.
Right.
And so,
if only to avoid the arguments you'd have with your friends.
So, yeah, it's just.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the little girl, Carol Ann, I forget the actress's name, but like she's there's a kind of a famous picture of Spielberg where you know, he was like directing E.T. while Poltergeist was being directed by Hooper, and there's a picture of him like with Carol Ann in one hand and who's the
Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, Drew Barrymore in the other, and he's just like happily skipping down the suburban street with the two of them, and people wonder why Crispin Glover called him a pedophile, but like, yeah, no, he really fetishizes screaming children. Anyway, that's another part of the Spielberg brand is the cute little kid, and I mentioned that there's parts of this movie that annoy me. One of them is, my problem with Steven Spielberg that I started to have on repeat viewings of Jurassic Park, which is how he appropriated the thrills of horror movies and made them safe. Because if you're watching Jurassic Park as a kid, it seems like a really dangerous, scary, exciting movie where anyone could get eaten at any time because people do get eaten. But then you watch it as an adult and it's like, oh, you can tell like from 10 miles away that only like the really unlikable or expendable characters are going to get eaten, and these cute little kids are getting chased all over the place, but there's no freaking way in hell he's going to have a cute little kid get eaten by a dinosaur. I mean, he didn't even show Alex Kittner, you know, getting chomped by Jaws. He shot that scene, but he cut it out, and that's like the one time he did it. So with Poltergeist, it's like, I can imagine watching this, you know, and being the age of, like, the little brother character in this. And just being, you know, really, like, you know, thrilled. Like, this is the most gripping and exciting movie that you've ever seen. but because anything can kind of happen and it, you know, and it's scary, like, you know, the direction is scary, it's suspenseful, but like, it's so obvious that like nothing bad is going to happen to anybody. And in fact, no one, there's not one death in this entire movie, this nominal horror movie, you know, there's spooky imagery and there's a little bit of suspense, but, and there's some, you know, flat out kind of make you, you know, lean back in your chair stuff. Like when the big giant demon head comes out of the,
yeah,
the doorway at Craig T. Nelson. Yeah. Great Richard Edlund effect. But ultimately it's a safe movie, which is why I can't really enjoy it as much as an adult as I would if I were a kid. And that's like the problem with so many Spielberg movies.
I feel like the Poltergeist situation is the plot, and we'll get to this in a little while.
Yeah.
There's an inherent problem with the plot. But the movie's so well made. And I mean, it's not just the Panavision. It's all the crazy crap that Hooper came up with. Like, do you really think Spielberg came up with the whole strobe light, people walking backward thing? Because I don't. Because it's... You can see... This is awful. The scene in Texas Chainsaw where the girl is at dinner with the family.
Yeah.
Or she's the family's dinner.
Yeah.
Hooper manages to repeat some of the same tension in Poltergeist, only in an entirely safe movie that's none of the imagery is that graphic or even that disturbing.
Yeah, even the the one bad special effect in the movie is where the guy is hallucinating that he's tearing off his own face.
Mm, yeah.
And, like, A, number one, even if it was Steven Spielberg's hands doing the effect, which apparently it was, I have a hard time believing that Spielberg came up with that one because it's too gruesome for him. But then the other thing is, like... I forgot what my point was, but another point I wanted to say on what you just said is that a common thing with Hooper's movies is that they start slow and they gradually build to like a climate of insanity where everything is just going nuts by the end, and that's almost like what the second ending is tacked on for. And I guess Spielberg's been quoted as saying like that's his least favorite part of Poltergeist is the second ending, but the second ending is really Hooper through and through, because if you watch the last 20 minutes of a lot of like Toby Hooper's horror movies, they're all about just chaos. Like Hooper loves doing scenes of chaos.
Well, and not to tie too much into the sequel, but so Poltergeist is really plotted very strangely. It starts in the second act, then sort of tries to repeat the pattern of a first act. But it also has two sets of visitors to the cast. So at the beginning, you have the initial scientists.
Yeah, these three parapsychologists. And then, much later, like Zelda Rubinstein.
Zelda Rubinstein. And so you're deviating from the principal cast. You're getting away from Joe Beth Williams and Craig T. Nelson when those people are on. The actress who plays the female psychologist, what is her name?
Beatrice Strait.
Yes. She's third billed. She's amazing, and she has this one great monologue, and it just totally makes the movie hers, right?
Yeah, where she explains kind of why there are ghosts.
Yeah, and it's
because they're people who got lost along the way and dying or whatever.
Yeah, that's so good in this one, and in the second one, it's so not. but then you have Zelda Rubinstein show up later, and the tack
I really
on
don't,
ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
It lets you bring it back to the principal cast. And
And you know what's so weird about that is that, like, I hated when, like, the parapsychologists show up and they make the family leave except for Craig T. Nelson and Joe Beth Williams, like they show the little brother getting driven away. It's like, I wanted to see more scenes of the little brother being scared. He's good. But so then it's like when they get to the second ending at the end, they finally follow up on something that they were setting up in the first act with the little brother's clown doll. Like,
yeah.
He's scared of the clown doll at the very beginning of the movie, and you know that at some point that doll's going to come to life, but then it doesn't until the fake out.
Until the very, very end. When I was watching it this time,
it's
I'm like,
really structurally weird.
Doesn't the doll come to life right now? And no, it doesn't. It comes to life, an hour and 40 minutes later.
Yeah.
That's the other thing is all the kids disappear. So, if you've never seen Poltergeist, sorry, but the little blonde-haired girl gets kidnapped by the ghosts for most of the movie. She's barely in this movie.
Yeah.
The son makes it a couple more scenes, then he gets sent off to grandma's, which is, anyway, will come up too. And the older daughter stays with friends or something.
Yeah.
And so it really, the cast is always changing in this, 2-hour movie. And the pacing's just amazing in Poltergeist.
Considering how much crap they're trying to juggle, it's kind of amazing that it does feel cohesive while you're watching it, or logical. And by the way, the reason that there's so much crap going on is that even though the movie's credited as being the team of Victor and Grace plus Spielberg, apparently there were like at least 8 people who contributed to this story, and most of what they were contributing, however many other people there were, was taken from other stuff, like the whole Carol Ann being trapped in another dimension and people talking to her and hearing her voice talk to them, but they can't see her and it's echoing. That was a Twilight Zone episode called Little Girl Lost, which is written by Richard Matheson. It was a very popular episode. It was even parodied by The Simpsons on one of their Halloween specials, where Homer is, in another dimension. And then that's beside the fact that, whatever, it's a haunted house movie. I mean, that's not the most original idea in the world. The big high concept, twist was, let's put it in suburbia.
One of the other elements to it is that it's the very... the sort of how the planned communities movies that started around 78, 70,
the tract housing cinema.
Yeah. The big, the really negative look at it is, Over the Edge from, 79 about teenagers rebelling, but Spielberg had this as a central thing in most of his...
E.T. takes place in one of these tract housing
developments. E.T. looks like it takes place down the block from...
Yeah, exactly. I think it did. I think that's why they took that picture, because they were like filming on opposite ends of the street.
Gremlins has a very...
It's like a parodic version of, small town America.
And I feel like Back to the Future has it too.
Yeah.
And it just feels... This whole, but it's not exactly positive. Spielberg's isn't positive.
I would almost say that, like, if there's a consistent theme, it's that, like, it is very positive, and it's the invasion from outside forces, whether it's E.T. or a poltergeist or what, or gremlins or whatnot.
Okay, so E.T. Yeah, the whole neighborhood bands together to save E.T. Poltergeist, the only neighbor we meet is a shitheel. The prospective
right.
neighbors are morons, and the owner of the place is James Caron.
Playing an asshole,
but he really doesn't have very many lines. I think he has like 6 lines. It's sort of
no, but he's got such a great voice that
and his expression too.
Yeah, I love James Cameron. Karen.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Spielberg is undecided on it because it's nothing he has to deal with. I mean, You know, he's seeing something that is.
I guess we're getting into.
Are we giving him too much credit? Almost?
We're getting we're getting deep into the aesthetic of Spielberg discussion rather than
which is yeah. That's because we can't talk about the aesthetic of Hooper because it doesn't feel. It feels like. I think my resistance to grouping it with Gremlins and Back to the Future is something really simple. It's just that it doesn't have that Amblin Entertainment logo anywhere on it.
Yeah. Well, it's I agree it's less of it's got less of the Spielberg flavor than those two. But that's because, you know, it's scary. I mean, when has Spielberg tried to be scary besides you know, the child endangerment scenes in every one of his movies. Okay, this is, let me put it this way. This is maybe, I guess this and Jaws are like the two times that Spielberg's tried to be scary and has actually succeeded. And this is scarier than Jaws, by the way, or at least, you know, more gripping. Nah, I can't really say that. But that's, I don't know what that's, yeah, this movie's an enigma. No wonder they couldn't produce the special edition DVD properly.
Well, okay, so
to get back to praising it, the cast is
excellent. That's actually
I really of... I didn't I'd always heard jokes about like how lame Craig T. Nelson is because of Coach.
Yeah,
but,
and he's great in this. And then you're like,
but I'd never seen Coach, so I didn't really have an opinion on him. But yeah, he's great in this. And yeah. I didn't know anything about Jo Beth Williams.
Yeah,
but as the mom, like, she has to carry the emotional weight for all these like absurd scenes where she, you know, she's crying because she just felt her daughter's spirit walk through her.
Yeah,
and that's just like pure acting, having to sell that stuff, and you know, and the treacly James Horner music or. Sorry, the other guy, Jerry Goldsmith. But yeah, she's so good.
Yeah, she's fantastic in this. And I had only ever seen her since I saw Poltergeist so late. I'd only ever seen her in sort of goofy end of your career type stuff. And so coming back and seeing her in Poltergeist, she's just great. And yeah, I mean, Craig T. Nelson, I did actually grow up with some Coach, not a lot of Coach, but some Coach. And so it was hard to, but Poltergeist, it's very cinematic in that even when you watch it pan and scan, it's clearly a movie and it's clearly separate from any they can't really be preconceived notions of the cast, but they're sort of preconceived notions based on their subsequent career. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, about the shifting focus of the movie, there's one way in which the focus shifts around in the structure that's very Spielbergian to me, and it's Spielbergian in the way in the safe horror thing I'm complaining about, and it's the fact that almost kind of predictably, like every scary Toby Hooper-ish scene is followed by like a comic relief scene, and it's so well made that you don't stop to think about it. But if you do stop to think about it, probably the most obvious time that it happens is like right after Carol Ann disappears, you know, which is this horrifying traumatic event for the family. And it becomes, you know, the point of the movie for most of the duration is getting her back. Like right after she disappears, they bring over the trio of parapsychologists or investigators or whatever. And it's a big joke scene. It's like a big wind up and a punchline of like, oh yeah, one time we saw a rock move across the room 1/2 inch per hour. And then they're like, that's interesting. Oh, and then they open the kid's bedroom door and stuff is flying all over the place.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's a joke, and it works, and it's good, and the effects are amazing, so you don't think about it. But if you stop and think about it, it's like, Does the movie just like totally undermined any sense of danger that it had? It's basically reassuring you that everything's ultimately going to be okay. You know,
and
like,
that scene
don't worry,
comes
kids.
After the indeterminate period between Carol Ann disappearing and the three Ghostbusters showing up.
Mm-hmm.
It's long enough. I think they say it's 2 weeks or something like that, that the kids have been out for 2 weeks, something like that. And I think they get away with a lot because of that, like the sort of fade out, fade in, that they're able to break the tone a little. But yeah,
real horror movies aren't supposed to make you feel safe, and real horror movies don't give you comic relief unless they're setting you up for an even bigger, for like the next shock. But in this movie, it's like the shocks are in this, they're doled out. They're not shocks. They're, you know, they're shocks, but they're doled out. You know what I mean?
And I think some of the dulling comes from the fact it does open with the first paranormal encounter. And then the chair scene is, you know, the next day, I think.
Yeah. And it's like a funny, you know.
Yeah. So it's all very gradual to the point that, you know, when it does become dangerous, your expectation is sort of lowered.
Yeah.
So when they finally do have something really shocking, like the giant head,
mm-hmm.
it gets a better reaction.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, it's, you know, we keep talking about all these tonal and structural contradictions and problems, but gosh darn it if it doesn't all work.
And I think to some degree it's what makes it work. I don't know if you noticed, but when they're interviewing Craig T. Nelson, he says that their oldest daughter is 16 and Jo Beth Williams is 32. And so everybody's like, well, that means that she was 16 when she married, when they had the kid. But that doesn't really fit with the character at all. You know, Jo Beth Williams was sort of in that 80s. She was in The Big Chill. You know, she was one of the grown-up, smart, ex-hippie women. And she even is an ex-hippie in the movie. And so, for me, it always adds this layer of, well, maybe the older daughter is like a stepdaughter or something like that, something weird like that. And it just, you know, just adds I feel like they're even more.
Yeah, maybe they put her up for adoption again between this and the sequel. That's why she's never
when
mentioned in Poltergeist 2.
People are beaten to death by their boyfriends. We ignore them for the sequel. Do you think Christopher Nolan's going to mention the Joker in Batman 3? No.
No. Well, apparently they filmed a scene of saying that she was off in college, but then they didn't even have the decency to include it.
No, they didn't, and it's really, that's one of my big issues with it. And that Dominique Dunn, is that her name?
Yeah.
She's great. I mean, she's sort of, there's so much more bite to her than if she were the acerbic kid in one of the more Spielberg movies. Like, she's going to be like Corey Feldman in Gremlins. Like, not
right.
Really. Yeah. But right. The kid's really good. And
yeah.
I just think that by skipping around so much, they sort of create this thoughtfulness that might not actually be there.
Yeah.
But yeah. See, the thing is did they notice that and edit it for that reason, maybe?
No. I mean, but that's the epitome of high concept, and, you know, I guess we're about to segue to
low concept,
like,
yeah.
The epitome of, you know, what Hollywood calls high concept, which is a gimmicky, fantastical idea, basically, is that, like, it doesn't require any thoughtfulness afterwards. Like, if you come up with a high concept, like, oh, I don't know, a human gets sucked into a cartoon world, then you don't actually have to be clever with it because it's just like the spectacle of it happening. And Poltergeist is like that too. Like nothing really, I mean, the effects are clever, but that's not the same as like the story being clever. And the last little dig I'll take at Poltergeist is that when Zelda Rubinstein shows up, I hate that like she has all the answers and she acts like she's seen this happen a million times before and none of this really weirds her out because, I mean, don't the parapsychologists like know her? Aren't they like acquaintances or something? Yeah, they are.
Yeah, they are. They bring her in.
So how come this is all new to them, but it's nothing, it doesn't seem like anything new to Zelda Rubinstein?
Well, think about it like this, though. Zelda Rubinstein turns out to be wrong.
Well, that's true.
So
yeah,
she says
this house is now clean, and
right,
it's like,
and she's wrong.
Yeah, no, it's not.
Really wrong. So I mean, it's almost like you can just, you know, that you can apply my whole unintentional complexity theory to this.
Yeah, any complexity is purely unintentional.
Which is kind of what makes me love it, actually.
Well, I mean,
it's just the right mix.
It is the right mix because I mean, I'm complaining. I'm nitpicking a good movie here on a very personal level.
All right.
And my last nitpick, which I was that whole high concept thing was a preamble to my nitpick, which is that when Zelda Rubinstein shows up and she has all the answers, like that's a lazy screenwriting device to just like have someone who knows what to do. And then what she knows, since the movie's dealing with ghosts, like they just come up with like this a religious approach to explaining what ghosts and the afterlife are, where it doesn't like where there is an afterlife and basically a heaven. I mean, she's talking about like go into the light, and you know, like heaven is always, you know, supposed to be a pure, pristine, well-lit place. And then she even talks about the Beast, who's like trying to trick Carol Ann into not, you know, returning to her family, or it's the Beast that wants to keep Carol Ann in this, you know, netherworld. And it's like, well, you know, could it be Satan? You know, the Dana Carvey church lady line.
Are we segueing right now?
Yes, now it's time to
segue. But it's not Satan. It's a psycho Christian preacher.
Yeah. Then for the sequel, they bring Christianity into it. Yeah.
And Christianity is bad, by the way.
It sure is. in Hollywood movies. Yeah.
Poltergeist 2 is the most negative.
It's the most anti-Christian film.
It's the most anti-Christian thing ever. I mean, it's just like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Poltergeist 2 is everything.
It's just, yeah.
Every bad or lazy sequel stereotype plus the Native American element.
It friggin' opens with a Native American with a magical Indian driving through the desert. You know, it's not a good sign.
I'm sitting there and I'm like, is this The Exorcist Part 2?
That's what I was thinking, because Exorcist Part 2 opens with all this like mythology being established, and it's based on, you know, another culture's mysticism from another part of the world, and it has nothing to do with anything from the first movie. They're just retroactively applying it.
And I mean, they retroactively apply just. Okay, so Jo Beth Williams, you find out the second movie is actually Luke Skywalker, and her mother was Anakin Skywalker, who never turned into Darth Vader, but was just a really powerful Jedi. And it turns out Carol Ann is a Jedi too.
Yeah, they all have a familial connection of ESP, basically.
I mean, there's even a scene with Zelda Rubinstein, who I think I just said something nice about 3 minutes ago, and I just wanted to say that she's in this movie a lot, and she's awful. And the reason she's awful is because she's in this movie a lot. When you're only in a movie for 4 minutes, but it's spread out over 10, it works better than if you're in a movie you know, for 30 minutes and you're terrible and the movie's only 90 minutes. But yeah. She has this scene with Jo Beth Williams. She's like, you know, Carol Ann has it. Mother had it.
Yeah.
And I
sorry.
Thought you had it.
I'm sorry. I forgot to mention this in the last movie.
And so that also adds the layer that maybe if they were a normal family and didn't have, you know, a defective whatever, this wouldn't have happened to them at all.
Yeah. Well, in the first place, you know, speaking of not happening at all, you know, we didn't talk about why the house was haunted. There's kind of a quotable scene at the end of Poltergeist where Craig T. Nelson is shaking James Caron. And he's saying, you moved the headstones, but you didn't move the bodies because apparently the housing tract was built on top of, you know, cemetery land. You know, which doesn't make sense because, what, was it only their house that had the bodies buried under it? Why not the whole rest of the suburbia, which maybe in earlier drafts it was. But anyways, so, you know, okay, so for Poltergeist 1, that's a, you know, decent enough explanation as to why there were ghosts in the first place. But, you know, if you're doing Poltergeist 2 with the same characters, you got to come up with some reason. And they're not living in that house anymore. It got sucked into a wormhole at the end of the first movie. So you got to come up with a reason for why they're still going to be ghosts coming after them. And apparently it's, you know, it's not just because Carol Ann is so special. It's because among the bodies, it has to be among the bodies because it, oh boy, I mean, it's like.
No, it's not among the bodies. It's even worse than that. It's in a secret cavern underneath the graveyard.
It's underneath the grave. There's a secret burial area underneath where the bodies were buried that were haunting them in the first movie. And I guess, but I mean, they had to have been among them, right? I mean. Kane and his followers had to have been among the ghosts in the first movie because that's when they got their taste of sweet, sweet Carol Ann, and then they were hooked for the rest of their dead lives.
Well, he had to be, I think...
Oh, no, he was part of the Beast.
He was
wants
part
to
of the
keep
Beast.
Her.
Let's say he was the Beast, because they referred him as the Beast at one point in Poltergeist 2 after the actor who had played the character had died, so he was no longer on screen, just talked about. So I think, you know, if we're gonna
but this is like Cool World, like trying to fucking make sense of Victor and Grace's fucking illogic.
But okay, so yeah, I mean, the other thing the opening scene establishes is that ghosts are real and that
of course
people know about them, like, not you know, not like in the first movie where only a couple people knew about them. No, everybody should know about them because the Native Americans know about them. And so, you know, it ties it into, like, the Earth, which is – and there's a spear at the end.
Well, see, that's something that reminded me of Cool World is – remember how Cool World opens with the spike that connects that connects the two worlds? And then, like, it disappears for the rest of the movie until the very end when it causes all this haywire? Well, Victor and – Grace really like introducing stuff in the first few minutes of a movie just so they can bring it back at the very end to kind of resolve things. Because, yeah, Poltergeist 2, like, and Will Sampson, who's the Native American mystic who helps the family in this movie, Will Sampson is, like, given a magic spear by another Native American. We don't know what it is.
No,
we don't.
But the other Native American's not there. Did you catch that?
He was a ghost
there.
Or something.
He was a ghost.
Yeah. Right. And then – so then at the end when, you know, all hell's breaking loose and Craig T. Nelson is flying around in the Twilight Zone trying to grab Carol Ann, how do they defeat the Beast? Well, Will Sampson tosses him a spear so they can throw it at the monster and it dies. Yay.
Yeah. What else do they change in this one? Okay, so Dominique Dunn is gone, and they don't mention her, and it's like the character never existed.
Yeah.
Maybe nobody wants to talk about Poltergeist for a 25th anniversary because, you know, the studio enforced such terrible things on them, like, yeah, you just have to pretend you didn't know the person who was brutally murdered by her boyfriend or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the actors shot the scene where they said she was going off to college, so they thought that the character still existed. But it's more like, yeah, they just didn't think anybody in the public would they would all just politely forget, repress all memory of it.
Yeah, so she's gone, and then it means that Carol Ann has a lot more lines.
Yeah, and that's really not good, no. Because, you know, part of what made the little girl effective in the first movie is that, like, she was a really little girl, so everything she said had that kind of creepy "I'm just learning to talk" cadence to it. I mean, she wouldn't have said the famous, you know, tagline "They're here" the way that she did if she weren't a real little girl. But in this, she's just, you know, like a grade schooler, and she's fine. She can still act, but it she doesn't have like the effect or presence.
Yeah, and movie. then there's the big shift between Craig T. Nelson as the, you know, lead, but in this one, Jo Beth Williams gets top billing, and she has no character arc except finding out that she's a Jedi. Oh, and her mother dying very conveniently when the family's having money problems, and so the mother dies, and they have a place to live.
I didn't notice she was top billed, but yeah.
Yeah. And
they
so
do, yeah.
Then Craig T. Nelson, like, he bickers with Will Sampson, and then eventually becomes, you know, we get this great build-up where Will Sampson's talking to him about the battle he will undertake and, you know, like his willpower. And the battle he undertakes is floating around in front of a blue screen and like looking scared.
And puking up a tequila worm that turns into a big monster, which was one of the few scenes I did see on TV.
That was... Okay, so in the Leonard Maltin review, he's like, be warned, you know, it's not exactly highbrow. There's an actor billed as the vomit monster.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I read that review when I was a kid. I was expecting, like, some liquid vomit monster, right? Like,
right.
And instead it's, you know, a metamorphizing demon or something. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's not a vomit monster.
Which was actually designed by H.R. Giger.
Yeah, because they brought him in after Julian Beck, who plays the bad guy, died. And I just want to say that that guy's creepy. Like,
yeah, I mean, but it's easy to be creepy when you're dying.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's the scary thing, is that he's literally dying in the scenes that they filmed him in. So the reason he looks like a pale, ghostly specter is because he is at death's door, literally.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
His character is, and he was. Julian Beck was.
Poltergeist and, 2 is not scary, but he's very scary.
No, yeah, I mean, he's kind of the one good thing, and like kind of the one iconic thing that people ever remember or take away from this movie is the scene where he shows up on a bright and sunny day and it's raining on him alone, and then he comes to the door and he's like, it's like a vampire thing. He keeps saying like, let me in, like he can't come in unless he's invited in. And he has this scene with Craig T. Nelson where he kind of plays a mind game with him, and then he's really soft spoken and everything, but then it just culminates in him going, you're gonna die. And it's kind of like funny because it's so outrageous, but that's like the best scene of the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And then there's that terrible scene where Craig T. Nelson impersonates him.
All right, he's
possessed because the guy died.
Because he was in the tequila form that he swallowed.
Right. And so I was like, is Craig T. Nelson going to do an impression? Like, is he going to do a – and he doesn't really. It's like they he couldn't pull it off or something.
Yeah, he just acts real psycho.
Did you notice the hair?
No, did they have his hair start changing color or somewhere?
No, at the beginning of the movie, Craig T. Nelson has like really long hair. He practically has like a bob cut, and then it disappears at some point. Like maybe for the funeral we don't get to see of the mother who, you know, it's just,
yeah,
it's everything bad about a sequel, yet. The guy who directed it, Brian Gibson, I noticed at some point is that he understands what makes the first one work. And so he'll do these moments where it's just like he's incapable of doing it well, though. And they maintain the Panavision frame here, and then it's like they try to mimic what's going on, and it does not.
Yeah, but I mean the moments. I mean, when he tries to imitate the scary parts from the first movie, that's really where like Victor and Grace kind of fail once again, because you know the scary stuff in the first movie was, you know, it was either like Steven Spielberg's childhood fears of clown dolls and scary looking trees, or it was Toby Hooper outrageousness, like pulling your own face off. But in Poltergeist 2, it's like a kid gets attacked by his braces.
Yeah. That was one of the things I realized when I was watching it during the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes of Poltergeist 2. They don't establish those fears. And the only fear anybody has is Craig T. Nelson of a TV set.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
that was such an 80s sequel thing, wasn't it? Like to have a big goofy joke about the memorable thing from the last movie. Like, no way are we having a TV set. No, not going through that again.
Yeah, I think that Lethal Weapon sort of made it clear when in the second one, you know, Danny Glover's like, not again, over and over. But yeah,
we didn't explain how this movie is so anti-Christian.
We got to get to that.
The reason that the family is being haunted, even though they're at another house, is because they were followed by all the ghosts of people who were buried under the cemetery that was under their house, and it was a evil messianic preacher. This Julian Beck guy we're talking about, and his flock of followers, and he sealed them in a cave because he thought the end of the world was coming, and it didn't come, and he didn't let them leave, and they all horribly starved to death. And the scene, the only thing that sells the scene where Jo Beth Williams is having her Jedi mind ESP flashback thing and actually, like, you know, getting visions of the people stuck in the cave with Julian Beck, the only thing that makes that work is Jerry Goldsmith doing some nice creepy kind of Christian hymnal stuff.
Yeah.
But it's very much playing on the fear of creepy end of the world Christians.
Yeah, the Jerry Goldsmith score, it's got synthesizers at one point, and I was like, this is the first time I've ever heard Jerry Goldsmith use synthesizers. Yeah, I guess I'd read that it was a very schizophrenic score.
Yeah, well, actually, like it's more impressive and ambitious than anything in the movie, because did you notice that like in the stupid climax where they're all floating around in the fifth dimension and the beast is there and they're trying to grab at Carol Ann and the Indians throwing them the magic spear, when all that crap is happening? The music is like really, it turns into like this really omen sounding, like, oh, hey, oh, hey,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like I rewatched that scene twice, like just for the, you know, for all the effects that were going on and all the nonsense. And I noticed that, that chanting is, they're chanting the words to the Christian hymn that Julian Beck goes around singing, you know, God is, so if you go back and listen to the scene, the chanting is going, God is in his holy temple. And I was like, wow, way to go, Jerry Goldsmith. That's adding a lot to a movie that doesn't deserve it.
Oh, yeah.
Really went out of his way to try to help it.
And the other 80s sequel thing this one does is it has the subtitle.
Sure.
But in this one, the subtitle sequence, instead, the other side is literally there for 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Yeah. It's not a big part of the movie.
No, it's just.
And there's, I can't think off the top of my head, but yeah, sometimes you would get a movie where the sequel had a subtitle that implied something that the movie wasn't really about. It was when it was really just like more of the same.
Yeah.
Well, okay, Freddy's Revenge, let's say. That's a terrible example, but Freddy isn't getting revenge on anybody. He's going after a completely different group of people.
Right.
Or two.
Yeah, it's just... It took me a while to decide what I thought of Will Sampson in this, just to be completely off topic. And I think I liked him because...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, considering he's playing the cliche magic Indian character who has, like, no personality, he's still kind of interesting to watch.
Yeah, there's just something about it. And I think it's because Craig T. Nelson's story is so weak and Joe Beth Williams' story is non-existent. That's the weird thing about it is that her her Jedi powers are really not consequential to the story at all.
Yeah, that is weird. It doesn't end up like helping them in any way. I think like the climax of that, you know, aspect of her is that eventually they take her to the burial site so that she can have the flashbacks and that they can explain who this Julian Beck guy is.
Yeah. Oh, and you were saying about the first one, didn't people know about Zelda Rubinstein, who knows all about ghosts? In this one, she's like got a picture of the bad guy, but nobody knows anything about him except Joe Beth Williams.
Yeah, and
so
again,
it's like, yeah, they keep files on all the bad ghosts that are out there.
This was the precursor to Ghostbusters, and then it was the post after Ghostbusters. It was a lot like it. Especially in that there were three parapsychologists in the first movie. But, yeah, you know, I mean, but, like, again, fucking Grace and Victor, like, don't even do Zelda Rubinstein any favors because not only does she have the stupid, you know, not only does she not do anything, but they totally, like, sabotage her presence in the movie because the movie opens making a big deal out of Will Sampson. And then, like, after he does that whole, you know, Matt shot, like, apparently he climbed, like, to the top of a mountain in Monument Valley, California, and to get the magic spear from his Indian ghost friend. After all of that, then, like, he just, like, pulls up at a, you know, at the site where they're digging under the house, and Zelda Rubinstein's just kind of there, like some nameless excavator. It's not much of a reintroduction. They didn't like, and there's no reason they had to put her in there. Like, they could have given her like a proper introduction later on, but no.
She disappears at the end of the movie. So the movie ends with them defeating the bad guy. And oh, the other sort of anti-Christian thing would be that apparently everybody goes to heaven in Poltergeist. But at the end of the movie, they hug everybody. It's a really stupid hugging scene between the family, Zelda Rubinstein and Will Sampson.
That was so awkward. That was just
Will Sampson and the son shake hands, and I'm like, you guys didn't even talk to each other this whole movie.
That was so awkward. That was just like, how does the movie end? I don't know. Everybody hugs.
And I was for some reason I paid close attention. And Zelda Rubinstein disappears when they say goodbye to the guy who's driving away, to Will Sampson. Because there's this really bad, like, joke about Will Sampson wanting their shitty station wagon.
Right, and then he takes it, and then Craig T. Nelson is like, wait, no, I don't want to give it to you. And then they run after him, roll credits.
But no Zelda Rubinstein. She vanished. She disappeared.
Yeah, she just walked the other direction down the road.
And she's not really helpful this movie. Like, in fact, I would say she's so unhelpful. She's negligent. She's a negligent psychic because she like comes to the house and talks to Joe Beth Williams, tells her she's a Jedi, and she's like, "Ooh, you're gonna have to watch out for this bad guy," and she just goes home.
Yeah,
it's.
Do you think they meant to include references to the Beast at all, or that they only had to reintroduce the idea of the Beast once Julian Beck died? Because if they didn't, then it's confusing as to whether or not Julian Beck is the Beast, or if the Beast is just some amorphous blob of souls that Julian Beck is connected
part
to.
Of, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Because, yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's an answer. Just wondering.
Poltergeist 2 raises more questions. That's why they had to make a Poltergeist 3, obviously.
Yeah. Which they recast the Julian Beck character for. They bring that character back again because, you know, what else are you going to do? That's the thing. It's just like, it's just so lame that they felt like they needed a villain.
And they needed a villain, but...
Which just makes the ghosts not, like, intimidating or imposing.
Especially once you realize that nobody... Because in the third one, the only returning cast member is the little kid, the girl.
Yeah.
And so it's like, did the parents...
Oh, and Zelda Rubinstein again.
Yeah. Did they up the ante in Poltergeist 2? Are they going to kill the parents? And so I was kind of waiting for that. Because they really set Craig T. Nelson up a couple times. Like, Jo Beth Williams is able to send away the evil spirit by reassuring Craig T. Nelson she loves him, but... You know, there are some other points where he could have gone very easily, and it would have been very surprising since there were no deaths or actual physical danger. That's the other thing about the Poltergeist movies is the
nobody
ghosts
dies.
Apparently aren't going to bruise you either. Like,
yeah, they won't even leave a mark. I mean, yeah, the most heavy implication was when they're trying to drive away in their car and power tools are coming to life and attacking them.
Did you find it to be a Texas Chainsaw Massacre reference?
I don't know. There were a lot. Chainsaws were very popular in the 80s.
Yeah, but because of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, and Evil Dead, but Evil Dead was paying homage. It was kind of a long-term effect.
Yeah, and I was wondering if they were like trying to pay homage to Toby Hooper, which you might see in any sequel, you know, paying homage to the first one, but
yeah,
with Poltergeist, but not, with all the controversy over who directed
it.
You know
what really, you know, what's another Grace and Victor moment is when Craig T. Nelson just knows to jump into the fire to go to the other side. That's just like in Cool World where, like, you know, oh, you know, let's go from cartoon world to the real world now. Okay, here we go, zap. Like, they went just by wanting to go.
Yeah, it's...
It's just anything can happen if Grace and Victor want it to happen. We're dealing with magical stuff, so there doesn't have to be logic within that magic.
Okay, so do you think Poltergeist 2... has more of the perception of respectability, and not respectability for necessarily being good, but for being popular, because they made a Poltergeist 3?
Yeah, but you know what? I think Poltergeist 3 is better regarded critically
than Poltergeist 2.
Than Poltergeist 2. Yeah, I think Poltergeist 2, even at the time, had kind of a Exorcist 2 rep. Actually, it's kind of parallel to the Exorcist 1 movies, because Exorcist 3 was like better reviewed than Exorcist 2.
Yeah.
It would have been almost impossible for it not to have been.
So, because Poltergeist 3, you know, it was very pre-internet. I guess if you read, would Poltergeist even have been in Fangoria?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, so then there would have been comments back in 1987 about whether or not Craig T. Nelson and Jo Beth Williams were coming back and all that sort of thing. But I'm comparing it to, in my head, the RoboCop 2 to 3, where they changed the cast. And because of Orion going bankrupt and being in the news, that was like a more public thing. That it was... there was like internal trouble. But with Poltergeist 3, I feel like it made it to the point where it adds this idea that there was a successful Poltergeist franchise, at least for two movies.
Yeah, no, I think that's how it's been regarded in hindsight.
Yeah, and it's just it's
by people
wrong.
Like us who never saw.
And now we have. And why didn't you ever? I mean, so you never went back to Poltergeist 1?
Nah, yeah. Nah.
It never occurred to me to see Poltergeist 2. As soon as I like stopped buying the Leonard Maltin books every December, you know, when I was in high school or something, it never occurred to me to see Poltergeist 2. So when we came up with this episode idea, I was like, sure, it can't be that bad because
there were three of them.
Yeah, I mean, right?
Yeah,
in the
80s. One.
And, you know, for,
yeah, yeah.
Those were shot on film and they had to come out in the movie theaters, right? They couldn't have been that bad. And then you see a Chuck Norris movie and you know better. But, yeah.
You know what surprised me the most about Poltergeist 2, or the only thing that surprised me, was that when the little girl says they're back, she doesn't say they're back, because that's how it became quoted in popular culture when it was parodied. You know, back. But that's how she says that they're here. It's not how she says they're back in the movie. She actually just goes, they're back. She's kind of like whining it.
She's acting it. You know, because she's got to act this
right.
one.
And as I was actually impressed because yeah, it would have been would have been silly if she went there back.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Poltergeist 2 does take its. I think Victor and Grace think, and they even said that they did what they wanted to do. You know, because they were produced it too.
Yeah,
I think they're earnest. I just think they're really bad.
Didn't you know? You were looking at their one of their IMDb's, and doesn't one of them do Christian movies now?
Yeah, there's Grace.
It's a strange,
yeah.
It's a strange turnaround. Maybe he's, I guess he's making amends for Henry Caine.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention was that according to the IMDb alternate versions page, there exists a 130-minute version of Poltergeist 2.
What the F?
Which would add, let's see, if it's 90 minutes exactly now, yeah, another 40 minutes of Poltergeist 2. And it's like one of those great descriptions. It fleshes out characters and does other stuff, and you're just like, wow, how could you fix Poltergeist 2 with more scenes?
Yeah, like, this movie needed more backstory.
if you
obviously
explained the very strange scene where the grandmother dies and the subsequent scene where they're like, we've got a house. yeah, it's...
I was surprised to see that the woman whom Joe Beth Williams' mom possesses at the diner so she can talk to Joe Beth Williams, that woman wasn't Yeardley Smith. Because she sure sounded like Lisa. But I guess she wasn't.
Oh, wow. I'd actually forgotten that scene. yeah. It's... Yeah.
It's not good, folks.
Yeah, and it's really bad because it makes all the nice things you think about the acting in Poltergeist 1, it makes those nice things sort of just go away.
Yeah, because they're all the same people. And
yeah.
So if you gotta put any time into this movie, just go on YouTube and watch the scene where Henry Caine comes to the front door. That's pretty good. You're gonna die!
The mall scene's good too because it implies that the mother isn't a very good mother. Because she lets the kid wander off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, Spielberg did not have anything to do with this. So
no.
We haven't talked about that at all.
Well, I think he, I don't know, a moment. It's funny that he wouldn't do this, but he would do Jurassic Park 2. But then again, that was a while later in different circumstances.
I wonder if it had to do with Amblin Entertainment, because it doesn't have anything to do with the Poltergeist franchise, then maybe Spielberg's interest in it waned immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Spielberg had also just gone through the Twilight Zone fiasco, so I wonder if his, you know, producing enthusiasm waned after Twilight Zone.
Possibly. Not enough for Gremlins or Back to the Future, though. But if you'll notice, those movies didn't have helicopters. So,
and neither does Poltergeist 2.
So, with that, our next episode is our Christmas special, everyone. Yay! It's a good movie is the original, Miracle on 34th Street, which I've never seen and I've always wanted to. Have you seen that one?
I have, but only as a child.
Okay, cool. And then our bad one is the beloved holiday classic, Silent Night, Deadly Night 2. And I you suggested Silent Night, Deadly Night, but I insisted that it was 2 because I've seen both of them, and 2 is just, you'll see, it's even worse. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
Thanks for listening.